Welcome to What the Religion, a journey beyond beliefs, where we delve into the profound mysteries of existence itself. I am your host, Maggie, and together we are embarking on a journey through the tapestry of the very complicated human belief system. If you are someone who is interested coming onto my show, whether you believe in the most outlandish of ideas, or you really don't believe anything happens when we die and religion is just a hoax, please send me an email to whattereligion@gmail.com. I think everyone has a story and I want to hear yours. And hey, if you want even more engagement, consider supporting me on Patreon. Every month I host a live stream where, well, we just kind of sit and chat. I usually will pull out my current religious book I'm reading and we can talk about it together, or we'll just talk about God, ghosts, or, really anything. Oh, and you also get a monthly sticker. If you don't want to send away five of your hard-earned cash, please follow me on TikTok for some bite-sized clips of behind the scenes of making this show and some other content that, well, I kind of just put up randomly. And well, that's it. Let's get back to the show. Okay, so I know it's been a while since our first episode into Hinduism, and I feel like I've been kind of putting it off a little bit because I don't think that I was doing what I wanted to do. I was going more into detail about, how Hinduism was founded and how do you join Hinduism and. And I just, I, that's not what I want to talk about. This podcast is not to dissect every aspect of religion. It's to find out what people believe and why people believe certain things and how that helps them to get through life and maybe how it didn't help them get through life. And I, I don't want to go into all the details about Hinduism or about any religion. I want to talk about beliefs. And so I had a whole outline for this episode and I put it off for a few weeks and now I kind of completely redid it. And I did it to how I want to do it. I thought by, covering all aspects of a religion, I would have a broader audience, but like I don't really care about that. I want to talk about what I want to talk about, and if you also want to talk about that, I think that's great. And so, yeah, I guess that was kind of a little rant, but I want to talk about beliefs and I want to talk about what you think, and I want to look at the stars and kind of wonder why we're here. And so that's what I'm gonna sort of do today. Now, obviously, I don't have someone with me, and so it's a little bit harder to get into the details of things. But sort of when I don't have someone with me or don't have someone with a certain religious belief or just belief in general, I'm just gonna kind of try my best in talking about what they believe, with. I guess the research that I'm doing, the videos that I'm watching, resources online, books. I'm just gonna try to gather what this religion specifically believes. Obviously, I'm not gonna get everything right, and this is a very brief understanding. What I really want is people to come on and. And I have actually been talking to a few people about coming onto the podcast, but everyone says that they don't have anything to talk about, or they aren't a real Hindu or a real Christian or a real because they don't follow everything or they don't know all the or all the little teachings. But that's not what it's about. I don't want to hear all the little teachings. I mean, if you are someone who is deeply devoted, I also want to hear your story, but this podcast is about hearing individual stories and understanding where individuals come from. Even if they come from the same religion, you're going to have different opinions and you're going to follow different aspects of the religion. And I want to hear why you specifically are doing that and what about your life made you do that. Because I think we're all human and I think we're all trying to figure out why we're here and what we're doing. And I don't think that comes from following every single aspect of a religion. And so if you don't think you have anything to say, I promise you, you have something to say. And I want to hear it and I want to talk about it. So again, that was just a little rant. We can sort of get into this now. What are the fundamental beliefs of Hinduism? What do they sort of think? So the core concepts of Hindu philosophy are dharma, karma, samsara, and moksha. And I'm going to kind of, talk about these sort of out of order to what I think makes sense. So samsara is basically rebirth. So if you don't know anything about Hinduism, they believe in reincarnation. The cycle of samsara is often visualized as a vast and an intricate tapestry woven within the threads of countless individual lives, so each contributing to the overall pattern of existence. Within this tapestry, souls traverse through various realms and states of being, propelled by the force of their karma, actions, and desires. So we'll sort of get into karma a little bit later and how that plays into samsara, because I mean, all of these four things are very interconnected and they all, bounce off of each other. So sort of imagine embarking on a journey through a vast and diverse landscape where each step leads to a new experience, a new encounter, and a new challenge. In this journey, one might find itself born as a human, endowed with intellect, emotions, and the capacity of self-awareness. Alternatively, one might take birth as an animal, guided primarily by instinct and survival, or perhaps as a celestial being in a heavenly realm, experiencing sublime joys and pleasures beyond earthly comprehension. Conversely, one might descend into hellish realms, enduring intense suffering and torment as a result of past misdeeds. Regardless of the form one assumes, each life presents a unique set of circumstances, opportunities, and lessons. Some experiences may bring joy, fulfillment, and growth, while others may entail pain, loss, and adversity. These experiences are not random, but are intricately woven into the fabric of samsara, guided by the principles of karma and cosmic justice. So, just as a wheel turns endlessly, so too does the cycle of samsara perpetuate the journey of the soul through countless lifetimes. Birth follows death, death leads to rebirth, and the cycle continues unabated until a soul attains liberation from the cycle of birth and death. So, really, in essence, the cycle of samsara is profound and a dynamic process. It's characterized by the countless flux of existence and interplay of various forces and energies. Each life, each experience contributes to the evolution of the soul, guiding it towards eventual realization, enlightenment, and ultimate liberation. So that was kind of a lot, but samsara is the cycle of rebirth or reincarnation. And what determines, I mean, obviously, I know I would rather be a celestial being than going to a hellish realm, right? And so that is all based off your karma and sort of what you do in your current life. I don't know what you're born into, like if it's your first life, like where are you born? Do you start at the very top? Do you start at the very bottom? I don't know. But I was kind of wondering about how we got stuck in the first place when, like how, if we were a part of this larger being, why did we even journey into this cycle of existence? Why did we do that? But and the, sort of the answer that I got was the concept of being stuck in this cycle of samsara is often attributed to ignorance and the influence of desires and attachments to worldly pleasures and material possessions. So this ignorance leads individuals to identify themselves with their temporary physical bodies and ego, forgetting their true nature as eternal souls connected to the divine. According to Hindu philosophy, the cycle of samsara begins when the soul forgets its divine nature and becomes entangled in the illusion of the material world. So instead of recognizing the transient nature of worldly pleasures and the impermanence of material existence, individuals become attached to sensory experiences and desires, leading to actions that generate karma and perpetuate the cycle of birth and death. So, I mean, I guess maybe in the beginning we didn't have any karma because kind of say it's generate karma, which kind of leads to the cycle of birth and death. But additionally, the concept of karma plays a significant role in understanding why individuals are bound to the cycle of samsara. Every action, thought, and intention leaves an imprint on the soul, shaping its future experiences and determining the nature of its rebirth. Positive actions lead to positive outcomes, while negative actions result in suffering and adversity. Ultimately, the combination of ignorance, desire, attachment, and the consequences of past actions that keep individuals bound to the cycle of samsara. Breaking free from this cycle requires spiritual awakening, self-realization, and the cultivation of virtues such as detachment, compassion, and selflessness. Through spiritual practices, moral living, and the pursuit of higher knowledge, individuals can gradually transcend the limitations of samsara and attain liberation, which is called moksha. But before we get into that, when I was reading a bit about samsara, I had a lot of other questions that I kind of wanted to know about. So I was, I mean, this idea of birth and death and rebirth. I had always kind of agreed with or thought that, or really, I guess it just enjoyed the idea of reincarnation. I feel like I have so many things I want to do in this life. It's impossible to get through everything. And so I really like the idea of being able to have multiple lives. And it always helped me if there was something that maybe I missed out on or I didn't go for, that maybe I really wanted to, but the cards just didn't really work and I wasn't able to do something. I always was comforted by the idea that, maybe I had done it in a past life or in a future life I would be able to do it. And that, I guess that kind of helped me, because again, I have so many things that I want to do, and it's just impossible to do everything. And I feel like I'm currently doing already so many things. And so at first it made me upset that I couldn't do everything. And then when I kind of had this idea of, well, maybe we reincarnate, and maybe the reason why I'm feeling so pulled to this one aspect of my life is because I had done it in a past life. And so I kind of, could put it to the side if I couldn't do it at the time, kind of reassuring myself that I had already done it or I could do it in the next life. And so, but all to say, life can be very exhausting at some times, and just moving into a new life right away can sound even more overwhelming. And so my question kind of was, does someone have a break after each life? And this is kind of what I found. So there's a belief in an intermediate state between death and rebirth, known as bardo in some traditions. This intermediate state is where the soul rests and undergoes a period of reflection and assimilation before taking on a new physical form. During this intermediate state, the soul may experience a variety of conditions, depending on its karma and spiritual evolution. For some, it may be a peaceful and blissful state, akin to a period of rest and rejuvenation. But for others, especially those with unresolved desires or attachments, it may be a more turbulent experience characterized by confusion or longing. Now, the duration of this intermediate state is not fixed and can vary depending on various factors, including the individual's karma and the circumstances of their death. Some traditions suggest that it lasts until the soul is ready to embark on its next journey, while others propose that it can be influenced by prayers, rituals, and the actions of loved ones on behalf of the departed soul. Overall, the concept of an intermediate state between lives allows for the idea that the soul is not immediately thrust into a new existence, but is given time to reflect, assimilate lessons from past experiences, and prepare for the next phase of its journey through the cycle of samsara. And when I sort of read this or you know, thought about this, this restful period, I mean, if you're not being good in your life, this restful period sounds like it may not be a restful period. It will be a turbulent experience. And I mean, I'm assuming that if this is what happens, there's something worked out and that, it can be, beneficial in some way. Because I feel like if you're being quote unquote bad in your life, and then you go into a turbulent afterlife resting period, and then you come back into a bad life, like how do you break from that? You know, it says that if you are, you know, good in your life, then you can go and you can rest and you can rejuvenate and you can think about what you had done, and then you can go into an even better life. But how do you break from that, you know, lesser side? Like, how do you, if you're not able to rest and reflect on what happened in that life, how do you then in the next life become better? I don't know. And so that break that I thought maybe you would have between each life, you may not actually have if you weren't being good in your current life. So I don't know, but I mean, maybe I'm missing something. Maybe it's not, you know, like you would think hell is, where there's no, I don't think there's really any thought in the Christian hell, as in, like, you're just going to be burned alive, or not burned alive, burned unalive for the rest of time. I don't think there's any reflection in that. How can you reflect if you're in pain constantly? And so maybe I'm missing something, and maybe it's not so much that picture of hell, but it is like a kind of an acknowledgement of what you had done, and that's what kind of brings you down, but it's also a reflecting period. I don't know, but I was also another question that I had was, are we connected? You know, I have these people in my life that I really love and want to be with forever in all the rest of my lives, and, you know, all eternity that I would love to be in. And they have an answer for that. I don't know. I mean, I grew up Mormon, and in that religion, when you go to the temple, you can be sealed for eternity. Now, Mormons don't believe in reincarnation. But they do believe in an afterlife, and you can be with your family for all eternity. So that's kind of why I was asking this question, because even though I'm not Mormon anymore, I still like the idea of being connected with these people that I am for a very long time. And so here's what the Hindus had to say about that. So, in the journey through samsara, souls may encounter one another repeatedly across different lifetimes. forming complex and interconnected relationships that transcend time and space. It's not uncommon for souls to share deep bonds with certain individuals, such as spouses, children, parents, or close friends across multiple lifetimes. These relationships are often characterized by a strong karmic connection forged through shared experiences, emotions, and lessons learned together. However, it's essential to understand that the specifics of these relationships can vary from one lifetime to another. While the same souls may come into contact with each other repeatedly, the roles they play in the dynamics of their relationship can evolve and change over time. For example, someone who is your spouse in a past life may appear as a sibling or a close friend in the current one, depending on the karmic circumstances and the lessons that need to be learned. At a deeper level, the souls of all beings are inherently interconnected and bound together by the universal force of consciousness and the divine essence that resides within each individual. While individual identities and personalities may change from one lifetime to another, the underlying soul essence remains eternal and unchanging. This interconnectedness means that every action, thought, and experience not only affects the individual soul, but also ripples out to impact the entire web of existence. In this way, the cycle of samsara serves as a profound tapestry of interconnected lives where each soul plays a unique role in the unfolding drama of existence. Through the journey of birth, death, and rebirth, souls weave their threads into the fabric of creation, contributing to the grand symphony of life in its eternal dance of evolution and transformation. So in essence, yes, you can sort of stay with people that you really love. And you know, I think that's really great to hear. And I think people really cling on to something like that. You know, nobody wants to think that their loved ones are going to be gone forever. That's kind of a horrible thought. And this kind of answer that, yes, like, you do stay together, you know, all the life experiences that you go through together can really bond your souls, you know, depending on which life we're going to, what lesson we need to learn. Our lives can look drastically different from each other, which kind of, you know, leads to the fact that their life will also be different. And so those relationships can kind of, you know, change. And so, yeah, that is samsara, that is rebirth. And we're going to kind of get into karma now. So I think everyone's probably heard of karma. It's a widely used term, I think, even if you don't realize what you're saying. I think a lot of people use this term. And karma and samsara are pretty connected. So karma is the law of cause and effect. It's one of the foundational concepts of Hindu philosophy and spirituality. Karma derived from the Sanskrit word meaning action or deed. It underscores the interconnectedness of all beings and the dynamic nature of existence. So sort of at its core, karma teaches that every action, whether physical, mental, or verbal, sets into motion a chain of cause and effect. Just as a pebble thrown into a pond creates ripples that spread outward, our actions send out energetic vibrations that reverberate through the fabric of reality, shaping our experiences and influence on our future circumstances. So that kind of goes to show that we are connected, even if you don't love someone, if you're not doing great things to them that sort of affect them, that can sort of bond you together as well. So karma really ripples out, and it's kind of this whole web. Everyone is sort of connected, and everyone's karma is you know, sort of bouncing off each other's. So the concept of karma extends beyond the boundaries of a single lifetime, encompassing the ideas that our actions in past lives continue to shape our present circumstances and influence our future experiences. This understanding forms the basis of the belief in reincarnation, where the soul undergoes a series of births and deaths, each governed by the principles of karma. So in Hindu philosophy, the concept of eternal and indestructible soul, known as the Atman, lies at the heart of understanding the nature of existence and the purpose of life. The Atman sees the Atman is seen as the essential unchanging essence of an individual distinct from the transient physical of body and mind. I don't know if we talked about this in the first episode. It was so long ago. I'm so sorry. But Atman is you. So you are, I don't know, I don't want to say God, but I think that's kind of what it's conceptualized as. Like, you are part of that. God is not like this outside being. I don't think, like, you are essentially part of that. And so that's kind of what they see as Atman. So central to Hindu belief is the idea that the Atman undergoes a continuous process of evolution and learning through a series of births and deaths, as we now know is called samsara. Each physical body that Atman inhabits serves as a vessel for experiencing and navigating the complexities of the material world, offering opportunities for growth, self-realization, and spiritual advancement. These experiences are not viewed as isolated incidents, but are interconnected through the thread of karma, the universal law of cause and effect. Karma acts as the cosmic ledger, recording the moral consequences of an individual's actions and intentions, both in this lifetime and in past incarnations. Thus, the qualities of one's karma determines the circumstances and experiences encountered in each subsequent life. So it's kind of like a scorecard, right? It's keeping track of how you go about life, your intentions, whether they're good or hurtful, and your karma at the end of your life sort of determines how your next life is going to go. So, for an example, if an individual cultivates virtues such as compassion, kindness, and generosity of one life, they are likely to be born into favorable circumstances and enjoy positive experiences in their next incarnation. Conversely, if they engage in harmful or unwholesome actions driven by selfishness and ignorance, they may face adversity and challenges in their future lives as a result of negative karma. This understanding of karma and reincarnation sort of provides a framework for making sense of the diversity of human experiences and the apparent inequalities of life. It suggests that each individual is responsible for their own destiny and has the opportunity to shape their future through conscious choices and actions, which I actually really like. It kind of shows that people have to take responsibility for what they do. It's not like you're thinking that there's this outside source that is making your life horrible and there's nothing you could do about it, and you know, nothing is your fault. It's sort of like, no, you can take control of your life, and you can turn it around, and like, your actions actually do have consequences, and it's you. It's not this outside force. It's actually you, which gives you a lot of power, and it really lets you take control of your own sort of destiny. So the concept of reincarnation offers this perspective of life as a journey of self-discovery and self-realization, where the soul evolves and matures over countless lifetimes, gradually shedding ignorance and delusion to attain higher levels of consciousness and spiritual liberation. In essence, the belief in the eternal soul and the cycle of reincarnation underscores the interconnectedness of all beings and the profound interconnectedness of past, present, and future lives, guided by the inexorable workings of karma. Through the understanding and application of these timeless principles, individuals can strive for greater self-awareness, moral integrity, and spiritual fulfillment on their journey towards ultimate liberation. The quality of our karma is determined not only by the actions we perform in this lifetime, but also by the intentions, attitudes, and motivations underlying those actions. This means that not even seemingly small or insignificant deeds can have far-reaching effects, depending on the purity of our intentions and the level of awareness which we act, which I think is a good thing to keep in mind. If you're doing good acts just because you want to gain something for yourself, or you're doing it out of spite, is not good. Like, just because you're doing a good act does not mean you have good intentions. And I think that intentions part is kind of really key. Like, if you do something and you mess up and you accidentally hurt someone, but you meant no ill will, you meant actually something good, then you know maybe that can also help you a little bit. It's not just about what happens, it's about your intent. So by understanding the interconnectedness of past, present, and future lives, individuals are encouraged to take responsibility for their actions and to strive for spiritual growth and moral integrity. Rather than viewing life as a series of random events, the concept of karma offers a framework for understanding the deeper purpose and significance of our experiences, guiding us toward greater self-awareness and self-transformation. Ultimately, the journey of karma unfolds as a path of evolution and enlightenment, leading us towards the realization of our true nature and the ultimate goal of liberation from the cycle of birth and death. Through conscious awareness and intentional action, we have the opportunity to shape our destiny and align ourselves with the eternal principles of truth, righteousness, and divine harmony. By recognizing the law of karma, individuals are encouraged to cultivate mindfulness and ethical conduct in all aspects of their life. This means being aware of the consequences of our actions and striving to align our thoughts, words, and deeds with principles of righteousness, compassion, and truth. The doctrine of karma empowers individuals with the realization that they are the architects of their own destiny. Rather than being passive recipients of fate or circumstance, we have the ability to shape our future through conscious choice and intentional action. This self-empowerment lies at the heart of karma, inspiring individuals to take ownership of their. Oh my God, I can't talk today. This self-empowerment lies at the heart of karma, inspiring individuals to take ownership of their lives and to strive for personal and spiritual growth. Through right action, self-awareness, and the cultivation of virtuous qualities, one can gradually purify their karma, leading to greater harmony, balance, and well-being in their lives. Ultimately, the journey of karma unfolds as a path of self-discovery and transformation, guiding individuals toward the realization of their highest potential and the attainment of liberation from the cycle of samsara. Another thing that I was thinking when I was sort of going through that, during the period of sort of rest in between lives, do you know that you're dead? Like, do you know that you have, like, are you aware at that point of what the cycle is and what you're supposed to be doing? I don't know, like maybe that's sort of like the subconscious, like how I was talking about, well, what if you're not doing great and then you go into sort of a hell place and then you come back to life and you're still not doing great because you had no time to reflect or nothing was going on and you don't know. Maybe instead of that sort of cycle, it's kind of like if you don't do great in your life and you go into this sort of afterlife that's pretty bad, maybe during that time you know why you're there. You know what you had done in your life, and you know that this is a cycle now. And so even though you're kind of being tormented, you're also thinking like this was of my own doing. And this is, you know, kind of why I need to get out of this. And so maybe when you go back into a new life, you have sort of your subconscious being that you know what's going on and you know you should, you know, improve a little bit. And I'm sure it takes time, right? So I don't know if that made any sense, but maybe your subconscious knows that we're in this cycle. So when you go back into a new life, it's not stuck in this cycle of, well, I didn't get any rest. I don't know how to, I had no reflection. I can't continue. And I'm just the same person I was before. Maybe it's more of your subconscious knows that this is a cycle and that you need some improvement. And that little rest period that wasn't great, you know, maybe was for a reason. And it wasn't just a state of, you know, torment. Yeah, I don't know if that made any sense at all, literally. But we have been talking about liberation or moksha. This is what every Hindu is trying to get. This is the ultimate goal of Hindu spiritual practice. It represents the culmination of the soul's journey towards liberation from the cycle of samsara and the attainment of union with the divine. It is a state of profound transcendence where the individual soul realizes its inherent unity with Brahman, the ultimate reality that pervades all existence. So we talked about Atman, which is ourselves, but Brahman, I think, is their main god, and we are pieces of Brahman, and we're trying to get back to being one. Now, I think this is a little bit different from some religions, because from the religions that I know, you're trying to get into heaven to be in the presence of God, to spend your day with God. But in Hindu, you are trying to realize yourself again that you are God. And we're going to kind of go into this, but Hindus believe that the Atman never left you. You are Atman. You're just trying to realize that again. You've sort of forgotten it on this journey through earth, and you've sort of forgotten that you are Atman, but we're trying to get back to that realization, is liberation, moksha. So at the heart of moksha lies the profound realization of the self's identity with Brahman, the ultimate reality that transcends the boundaries of time, space, and individuality. This realization represents the pinnacle of spiritual attainment, where the individual soul, which is Atman, recognizes its essential nature as being inseparable from the supreme cosmic consciousness. So hopefully that explained it a little bit better. The union with the divine in moksha is not merely an escape from the physical realm, but a profound integration of the individual soul with the cosmic consciousness. It is a state of absolute freedom from desire and attachment, where the soul abides in eternal bliss and experiences the fullness of divine grace and love. In this state of realization, the individual no longer perceives themselves as separate from the universe, but recognizes themselves as an integral part of the cosmic whole. The distinctions between self and other, finite and infinite, dissolve into a seamless unity of existence. It is a state of profound clarity and lucidity, where the true nature of reality is revealed in its all splendor and majesty. This realization of oneness with Brahman brings with it a profound sense of liberation and freedom from the confines of the ego and the limitations of individual identity. The individual soul transcends the cycle of samsara and attains a state of eternal bliss and fulfillment. This profound realization of the self's identity with Brahman is not a privilege reserved for a select few, but it's indeed the birthright of every sentient being. It lies dormant within each individual, awaiting discovery and awakening through the journey of spiritual evolution. Hindu philosophy teaches that every soul is inherently divine, possessing the spark of the divine consciousness within. This divine essence is not something to be acquired or attained. It is already present in each being, waiting to be recognized and realized. The journey towards this realization is the essence of the soul's evolutionary journey. It is a journey of self-discovery, self-transformation, and self-realization, guided by the principles of Dharma, righteousness, karma, action, and moksha, liberation. In essence, the realization of moksha represents the highest goal of Hindu spirituality, the attainment of which brings an end to all suffering and the realization of the true nature of existence. It is a state of supreme bliss where the internal soul merges with the divine and abides in eternal peace and harmony for all eternity. And so I was reading this, and all my life I loved the idea, as I said, of reincarnation. And then I was thinking, well, in Hinduism, the goal is to stop reincarnating. And I was thinking, well, why would you want to do that? Like, having all these lives and these experiences, like, is great. Why would you want to stop doing that? And maybe that means that I'm, like, on my third life or something. I don't know. And I haven't gotten tired of it. I don't know. But their goal is to stop their reincarnation process. But I don't know, I couldn't really get an idea of what you do when you achieve liberation. Like what do you do? Do you like, but I guess that's not a great question because maybe the whole point, like our lives right now as humans, as animals, as you know, these things, we're sitting here trying to think of all these things to do, and I don't know, maybe achieving liberation is you're finally done with doing things and you can just live in happiness. It's like maybe it's like retirement, like you no longer have to work, you can just enjoy. I don't know, kind of how can you do this? Like we talked about karma, you need to have good karma in order to achieve liberation, but what are the paths to achieving good karma, to achieving liberation? And I think there's four different paths that Hindus kind of lay out. So the first one, and these are all the different yogas. So they have four books, I'm pretty sure, on the different yogas, or maybe it's one book with all four of them in. I don't know. But the first one is Jhana Yoga, which is the path of knowledge. So this yoga emphasizes the cultivation of wisdom and self-inquiry as a means to attain moksha. Practitioners of this path engage in deep philosophical studies, contemplation, and introspection to gain insights into the nature of reality and the true self, which is Atman. Through the discernment of which is transient and what is eternal, they strive to realize the self's identity with Brahman. This path is suited for those with a keen intellect and thirst for understanding the nature of existence, which I think is pretty cool. So I think that's a lot of studying books and kind of really thinking, right? And I'm not going to go too deep into all of these. But if you want to, I mean, read the books. The books are great. So the next one is Bhakti Yoga, which is the path of devotion. So Bhakti Yoga is the path of devotion and surrender to the divine. Practitioners of this yoga cultivate an intense love and devotion to a chosen deity or form of the divine, expressing their reverence through prayers, rituals, and acts of devotion. Through heartfelt devotion and surrender, they aim to develop a deep and intimate relationship with the ultimate reality. This path is suited for those with a strong emotional inclination and a longing for union with the divine through love. And I think this one is more like monks. Well, at least on the, you know, high end of the scale, which I think is pretty cool. Then we have the Dhanya Yoga, which is the path of meditation. This involves the cultivation of mental concentration, mindfulness, and inner stillness. Practitioners of this path engage in various meditation techniques, such as breath awareness, mantra repetition, or visualization, to quiet the mind and transcend the limitations of the ego. Through sustained practice, they aim to directly experience the transcendental nature of consciousness and attain unity with the divine. This path is suited for those with a contemplative disposition and desire for direct experiential realization. I have tried to meditate, and I think it's really good. It's really great. A lot of people, I mean, outside of Hinduism, it's really good for your mind, and I think even for your body, physically. I think obviously I could be better at this, but I think it can really do a lot. And it's really cool that this religion sort of places a big emphasis on that. And then you have the fourth one is the Karma Yoga, the path of selfless action. So Karma Yoga is the path of selfless action and service to others. Practitioners of this yoga perform their duties and responsibilities with a spirit of detachment and without attachment to the fruits of their actions. By offering their actions as a service to humanity or as an offering to the divine, they aim to purify the mind, dissolve the ego, and cultivate a sense of oneness with all beings. This path is suited for those who, with a compassionate heart and a desire to alleviate the suffering of others. This one, I think, is what I would have a challenge with the most. I feel like I have a lot of attachments. And I'm still kind of trying to understand the concept of not having attachments and having, and detaching from everything. I'm still trying to understand what exactly that means. To me, it sounds very lonely. But I think that I'm thinking about it in the wrong way. I don't think it's actually that that's actually what it means. I think it means more like things will happen in your life. People will come into your life. People will leave your life, and you'll have these things, and you won't have these things. But in the end, like, you just have to be okay with that. I think that's sort of what that means, but I don't really know. I don't know. I'm still struggling with that thought, so which is why I think that this one would maybe be something that I could practice or look more into. But these paths are not mutually exclusive. They can be practiced in conjunction with one another, depending on the individual's temperament and stage of spiritual evolution. Ultimately, each path offers a unique approach to realizing the ultimate truth of existence and attaining moksha, the highest goal of human life, obviously. Also, other lives. It's not just humans. Like, you could be a tree in your next life. You could be like a little bug or a lion. So it's not just human life. It's every living being on this planet has Atman. So the last thing of these sort of four philosophies of Hinduism is Dharma, which is righteousness. It's kind of how we know what we're supposed to do. So, like, what is the good and bad of karma? How do we know how to gain good karma? Is what I have gathered that Dharma kind of teaches. So Dharma is often translated as righteousness, a fundamental concept that encompasses a broad spectrum of duties, responsibilities, virtues, and moral principles. It serves as a guiding force that directs individuals towards leading a life in accordance with the cosmic order and social harmony. So sort of from what I've learned is Hinduism has a caste system of four different I guess castes or levels or stages, and according to which caste you're in, that's how you're supposed to live your life. In the Gita, the book that I'm reading, this man is on a battlefield, and he doesn't want to fight, and the whole thing is, well, you're supposed to be fighting because this is your caste. This is what you're supposed to do to attain good karma. And so I'm not like well versed in this area. I just kind of wanted to go through it. But there's different things. So there's the social class, and there's sort of stages of life that both sort of play into this dharma and kind of how you're supposed to be. So the duties based on varna, which is your social class. This is traditionally Hindu society has been stratified into four main varnas or social classes. Now I'm gonna try to pronounce these, but it's not gonna be even close to the right pronunciation. So there's the Brahmins, the Kshatriyas, the Vaishyas, and the Shudras. Each varna is associated with specific duties and responsibilities. Brahmins are entrusted with the roles of priests, scholars, and educators, responsible for preserving knowledge and performing ritual or religious rituals. The Kshatriyas are the warriors or rulers tasked with protecting society and upholding justice. The Vaishyas engage in commerce, agriculture, and trade, contributing to economic prosperity. And the Shudras perform service-oriented roles, supporting the functioning of society. Dharma guides individuals in fulfilling their duties according to their varna, contributing to the harmonious functioning of society. Now, this caste system, I think has a little bit of controversy around it. But in the beginning, when it was made, it was supposed to be you were determining your caste by your abilities. If you had great ability to lead, you would be put into one. If you had great ability to serve, you would be put into the other. And it wasn't based on your birth, which is kind of what it's turned into. And people for a while weren't they were looked down upon, and they were sort of ranked. And but that I don't that wasn't what it was about. I think in the beginning, which everything can turn, bad once it can get into the wrong hands. But in the beginning, I think the essence of this is you, like who you are and what skills you have and how you are able to do things. And it can also move throughout your life. And you can go into these different castes, and based on what your caste is what you're supposed to do in life. So say you're a waitress, you would be in the Shudras. I think, from what I know, you'd be in that caste system. And if you're doing well in your job and you're servicing your customers and you're, treating your customers well, you'll have good karma because you're fulfilling your dharma. Or like if you're a teacher and you're educating your students and you're being open to their ideas and you're really looking outward and learning and but then teaching, you're getting good karma and you're fulfilling your dharma, which is eventually going to lead to liberation. But along with this caste system, they also have duties based on ashrama, which is the stages of life. So the Hindu life is divided into four stages: studenthood, householder, retirement, and renunciation. So each state is associated with specific duties and responsibilities. During studenthood, individuals focus on education and personal development. The householder is characterized by the fulfillment of familial and societal duties, including marriage, raising children, and contributing to the welfare of the community. Retirement marks the transition to a more contemplative life, which individuals gradually withdrawing from worldly affairs and engaging in spiritual practices. Renunciation is a stage of complete renunciation, where individuals dedicate themselves entirely to the spiritual pursuits and detachment from material concerns. Dharma provides guidance at each stage of life, facilitating a smooth transition and fulfillment of one's responsibilities. And so those are sort of the two things that kind of play into how you're supposed to live your life, how you're supposed to gain good karma and fulfill dharma. And dharma, from what I've gathered, is like how the world is supposed to function. If everyone is fulfilling their dharma, the world will go round. And so that's kind of what I've gathered from that. And again, you can move throughout it, and the whole thing is kind of just stepping into your role and doing it well, and therefore you'll gain good karma. So yeah, I mean that was kind of a lot, right? But in essence, you want to gain good karma so you can gain liberation, and liberation is where you can sort of get back to who you were before, your true self. And I think that this is really great. And that was kind of a very large overview of what Hindus believe, and there wasn't many details. And I'm sure there's also like a million and two other things that the Hindus believe, and there's so many more rules and practices, but I didn't want to get too much into that. Otherwise, I could have a whole podcast on just Hinduism. But I just kind of wanted to get the base of what they believe and why they believe we're here and how they believe we get back to whatever they believe we're going back to. And that's the point of this. And I think, I kind of relate a lot to Hinduism. There's a lot of concept that I really enjoy. And I think that I would like to take a lot of that into my own life, this sort of philosophy. And again, this is one of the oldest religions. And I think there's probably a reason for that. And yeah, that's kind of it. And I mean, I don't really know how to end this because that was so much information, and there's no one to sort of, bounce it off of except for you guys. And so please comment on the podcast. What did you think? Do you think that it was total nonsense and you don't believe in any of it, or do you think that, it kind of may fit into your life? Or, send me an email and we can talk about it together. I can't stress how much this is a journey of everyone, because I think we are all connected. And I think that's a big part of what Hindus believe as well, is everyone is connected. And so yeah, I mean, that's it. Thank you for joining me on this episode of What the Religion. Just a reminder to email in for an interview at whattereligion@gmail.com. Even if you don't feel like you have anything to say, try anyway. I love hearing from you all. Also, follow me on TikTok at What the Religion, or consider joining my Patreon. And as always, I'll hear you later.